Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, delivering clarity in a world of constant noise. We'll go beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers who are shaping the future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up a little later, stay ahead with the stories that really matter. Coming up on the program, Sona 2025, bold promises or political fantasy? Doctors jobless while hospitals struggle, is there a private sector solution on the table? The president says NHI will reduce inequality and save lives. Critics say it's unfunded and unworkable. And Africa's climate fight at risk as the US cuts funding. It's Friday, the 7th of February.
We want a nation united in its diversity. At many difficult moments in our past, we found strength in working together towards a common goal. Through partnership, we brought peace and democracy to our country, which was once troubled. We overcame apartheid, a crime against humanity that denied people their human rights, that deprived them of the land and livelihoods, that sought to strip them of their dignity, that humiliated them. Through partnership, we overcame a devastating pandemic and rebuilt our country in the wake of state capture as well. Together, we have built durable institutions that support our democracy, that protect our fundamental rights and promote the well-being of South Africans.
Now, President Ramaphosa delivering his 2025 State of the Nation address, and in it outlined ambitious plans for economic growth, infrastructure investment, and governance reform under the newly formed Government of National Unity. Also pledging 940 billion rand for infrastructure, a 3% plus growth target, and a 20 billion rand SME transformation fund, while also addressing energy stability, crime reduction, and South Africa's G20 presidency. But how realistic are these promises, and what does it mean for business confidence and investment? I'm joined now by commentator Phumlani Majozi. Phumlani, a very warm welcome to you. So having watched the speech last night, did it inspire confidence or maybe leave more questions than answers?
Well, you know, the question I was asking myself before this Sona was, is this going to be a GNU Sona, right? In other words, is it going to sound different? Will the priorities be different? Will the approach be different given now that we are in, you know, it's the first one under the GNU? But then guess what? It was the same thing as usual, right? It was the same sort of a speech that focuses more on a push for government spending, a push for policies like this transformation fund. For me, I think this is not going to work. I think it will be a driver of corruption. It will be inefficient. It will be a transfer of wealth. It will be, you know, pressuring companies to, it will be more like double taxation, right? Because there are many programs that companies are already having to try and comply to empowerment. And then you come now again with this, you know, transformation fund. And we have many initiatives out there from the government that have been existing for a very long time. And they have not addressed the core fundamental problems in South Africa. So I think this approach of focusing more on excessive spending, there's nothing wrong, Jeremy, about targeting 3% economic growth. There's nothing wrong about, you know, ensuring that we we fight things like crime, because we need to have a secure environment for business, you know, to operate and attract investors. But the idea that we can continue on things like, I looked at the president, he's celebrating that they are going to expand, you know, the social grants, that they're going to increase them, that they want a sustainable sort of more grant in the country. Our problems, Jeremy, will not be addressed by, you know, government welfare. Mm.
All right, let's come back. Let's come back to spending in just a moment. But let me pick you up on that target of over 3% economic growth. Given some of the projections from the IMF and the World Bank, for instance, is this really achievable given our current economic trajectory?
No, for South Africa, I don't think it is achievable. 3% is too high. I've even had a chat with economists like David Root, who themselves, they see that 3% is too high. Given the fact that, remember, our challenges are much more deeper. They have to do with things like labor reforms, Jeremy. We have everybody from around the world. They complain about our rigid labor markets. They are not flexible at all. They have to do with the fact that, you know, we have issues of our labor force is underskilled, right? We do not have a competitive market. So all those issues are not being addressed by this government.
All right, let's,
must be,
let's look at infrastructure spending now. As I mentioned, 940 billion rand has been promised. Projects in transport, energy and water. Also last night, pushing public-private partnerships as a way to fund this infrastructure spend and stimulate economic growth. All well and good. But I'm wondering at this point, do you think the private sector has enough confidence in government policies to invest at this scale?
Not at this point, right? Not at this point. But by the way, they like the GNU, right? We have seen the market sentiment. It's very positive toward the GNU. We have seen the positive outlook on SA so far. But that's different from saying, is there any tangible different, you know, sort of change on the ground, right? And I think the markets or the business, the private sector, is looking closely at that. There are many risks, of course, with respect to, we've seen Bella, the divisions around Bella, the divisions around, you know, expropriation in the GNU that poses risks. But they love this, right? They love the idea of this GNU. But they are still watching as to, are we going to see tangible change? And then I think that is when they will come in later. If they do see tangible change, things in the positive direction, then they will commit to investing. For now, I'm not seeing that.
The president also emphasizing crime reduction and anti-corruption measures. That surely must be welcomed. He spoke about strengthening the investigating directorate against corruption. I guess the question is this going to be enough to restore business confidence? Or, as you've suggested a little earlier, is systemic corruption still a major barrier?
Jeremy, I have said that since the GNU took over last year, right, from June, I have said that I'm really, you know, I'm keeping my own data, right, where I'm tracking as to, in terms of crime, right, crime reports, in terms of things like all the key fundamentals in the economy, how will things be looking like by end of this year? It's all dependent on the direction of the data. It's nice to commit. It's nice to say we want to fight crime. We want to put in mechanisms to reduce corruption. But the corruption perceptions index, the murder rates, the crime statistics, we want to see them going down this year. It's a big year to track the GNU. We want the data by end of this year to see, you know, to go in the positive direction. And that is reduction in corruption and crime, more safety in the country. As soon as we see that on the ground, the data showing us that, that's when I think we'll see business gaining more confidence, and I'll gain more confidence too on South Africa.
And just a last one, the president also referencing South Africa's G20 presidency at the end of the year, saying it presents an opportunity to strengthen trade and investment ties. It's critical that government make priorities to make sure that it maximizes this leadership role, but already on the back foot, given that the U.S. Secretary of State has decided not to attend.
Yeah, well, we know the U.S. and South Africa's relations have been they've been rocky in recent years, I should say. So it's with Trump coming in. In fact, I did say last year that if Trump becomes the U.S. president, expect a showdown between South Africa and USA, right? Because we have seen South Africa doing things that the USA doesn't like, and I do believe that we've done many things, Jeremy, in recent years to antagonize the U.S. So I was expecting this situation. G20 is a big opportunity for South Africa, but I think that the theme should have focused more on how do we fight poverty in Africa, right? Because the greatest challenge, Africa is the poorest continent in the world. We should be talking about in this G20, we should be talking about how do we fight and reduce, you know, poverty in developing nations, especially Africa.
Thank you very much indeed, Phumlani Majozi. I appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, I'm going to return to the State of the Nation address in just a moment. But before that, our healthcare system is under immense strain. I don't need to tell you that, not just from patient demand, but also the shocking reality that over 1,800 qualified doctors in the country remain unemployed. These young professionals have spent years training and are struggling to find placement, while at the same time, our healthcare system is critically short of medical staff. Now, ProfMed has stepped in with FinDR. It's a platform, I understand, designed to connect young unemployed doctors with locum opportunities in medical practices and clinics. But beyond this initiative, and make no mistake, it is an important one, the question remains, why are our medical graduates not being absorbed into the system? What structural changes are needed? Craig Comrie is the Chief Executive Officer of ProfMed. Mr. Comrie, welcome. Thank you very much indeed. It's extraordinary, isn't it, that so many trained doctors are struggling to find jobs when we face this healthcare crisis that I've just outlined.
Thank you, Jeremy, and absolutely, it is amazing. I think worldwide, the demand for these skills has escalated tremendously over the last few years, specifically since COVID. And so it's amazing that last year we heard of the 800 young doctors exiting community service that didn't find employment. And this year it seems to have ballooned and doubled to 1,800. And so we have looked at this and said we have to find an opportunity to try and make sure these doctors are valued. The message to them is that they're not needed. And can you imagine going through school and 7 years of serious training, being probably amongst the highest skilled individuals in the country, and then not having employment?
So you've come up with this platform, FinDR. It's essentially a dating service, from what I can gather. How does it work?
Yeah, good description. We call it Finder, and it really is a space where young doctors under the age of 30, specifically that are looking for full-time work, can actually start to get almost a locum while they're waiting for full-time jobs. They can sign in and be available to then existing practices. We certainly know many of the GPs and bigger facilities are looking for locums, and we're trying to match the two together and make sure that in the interim they're taken care of and that they feel valued.
The key word that you've just used there is interim. It really is a band-aid, though. It's not going to solve the bigger problem unless more money is stumped up by Treasury.
Yeah, it has to happen in the context of the needs of South Africa. We've seen within, I think, even the WHO shares a statistic that says we have 0.3 of a doctor for every 1,000 people in South Africa. Their standard is 2.5. And so effectively, if you do the numbers, we're missing 100,000 doctors. Now, where do we get the funding for the 100,000 doctors? Certainly, some of the funding will come in the private sector through private demand, even in the absence of an NHI. But the public sector is urgently needing to cut queues and does need those skills, just needs additional funding. Some of that structural change needs to probably come in the sense of us being more efficient, both in the public and private sector. There is said to be in healthcare fraud to the value of about 20 billion rand a year. And so if we could just make an impact in that space, we could afford to employ certainly the 1,800 unemployed doctors quite easily.
Craig, beyond the funding and also the fraud that you've just outlined, you'll agree that greater systemic reform is needed in the way in which doctors are trained and placed.
Yes, absolutely. And so if there aren't additional funds available to train the doctors, I would advocate that we start opening that up to even the private sector, who can participate in the training of doctors. In that way, we can skill and perhaps even double the amount of doctors that are being produced. But we can't produce them and then not have funded long-term posts that are in line with their own career ambitions. Otherwise, the global market will snap them up very quickly. And so we need them to remain here. And so Finder is just a part of a message that we need to be structuring carefully to say, we need you here. We want you to participate in the future of healthcare. The healthcare itself, the healthcare system itself, with the advent of the NHI Act that now is in place, is trying to improve some of the access in healthcare. We are concerned still about funding. You need a growing economy to fund anything in terms of stretching the number of doctors we can employ.
And just a final one, you would have no doubt watched the State of the Nation address last night. President Ramaphosa, to all intent and purposes, doubling down on his commitment to NHI, promising it will reduce inequality, save lives, etc., etc. How did you engage with that?
Yeah, it was quite difficult to understand. I also watched the healthcare minister's comments afterwards, and so I think it's difficult to, it's unclear in terms of what the direction is. I mean, we welcome the fact there seems to be additional commitment to engage with the future of medical schemes in the context of NHI, but we don't quite know where that is going. In the interim, as a medical scheme, as part of some of the representative bodies, the associations of medical schemes, I think we'll continue with our constitutional court challenges in the interim until we're invited to participate in the ministerial advisory grouping.
Craig Comrie, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer at ProfMed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Let's return now to the State of the Nation address. And in that speech last night, President Ramaphosa doubling down on his commitment to the NHI, National Health Insurance, promising it will reduce inequality, save lives, and ensure fair treatment for all. He went on to outline plans for a single electronic health record accreditation for providers and ministerial advisory committees, while also pledging to modernize and expand hospitals. But here's the question. Can the government fund and manage this massive overhaul? There have been questions around this for a long time. Is it going to fix the healthcare system or break it even further? What happens to private healthcare and medical aid in this new landscape? Joining us now to take a look at some of these assumptions is Thanishan Naidu, Chief Executive Officer of the Health Funders Association. A very warm welcome to you. So the president saying last night, NHI, in his words, will ensure fair treatment for all. Not the first time that he said that, but we do have a public sector that is collapsing in that respect. I wonder if that promise is realistic, or do you think it's just more political rhetoric?
I think it's quite a challenging statement to make. And I think fundamentally part of the rhetoric and concern is there hasn't actually been any costing done with regards to NHI. So, you know, as any particular business plan, you've got to do your costing to understand what is the impact, how much will it cost. And unfortunately, much of the details that's required to understand how do you fix it? What is the game plan? How much will this cost? Is simply, unfortunately, missing from a lot of the details and the statements.
Is the reality that a project of this size and how and the time it's going to take to roll it out is almost simply impossible to cost?
No. I think it is quite possible. I think some of the private sector have actually done quite a bit of substantial research to understand it. I think this is exactly, you know, where the private sector can help. Because we do understand healthcare, you know, with the many years that we've worked in this environment, we understand the costs, we understand the expected claims, we understand how to contract, purchasing, you know, all of these type of things. So we are actually in a good position and understanding with all the skills and expertise to help to understand cost us ourselves as well. We've kind of costed something and we're working on, you know, a final kind of model of what this will take.
Without the costing, though, do you think that NHI is faces the danger of just being stillborn?
I think the Act currently, as it stands, I think will be really hard-pressed to achieve its objectives. Firstly, you know, the costing is one element. But I think there are so many uncertainties that lie within the actual rollout. For example, the impact that's going to have on the healthcare providers. So how will they be contracted? You know, how will they be accredited? What happens if they don't actually be accredited? You know, and so there's many unknowns and uncertainties, which is simply requires, you know, a collaborative approach between public and private sector, because we can provide some of the details to help navigate this. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm going to say this, you know, without the private sector, I do think it'll be a stillborn activity.
I'm wondering how your cost modeling is differing from what we have heard already in terms of estimates.
Sure. So I think we'll actually release, you know, in the coming weeks, kind of our estimates. But I can just give you an indication of how we kind of see the picture. We know, for example, that the public sector costs about 250 billion rand, which is funded through taxes. The private sector is about 280 billion rand, but that is after-tax discretionary income. Now, I think if you take a higher-level view, the way that the NHI fund is meant to be or intended to be is that 280 billion rand will be absorbed to the NHI fund. The only way that can actually happen is through raising taxes. So personal income taxes will have to be substantially increased. So our kind of crunching of numbers and so on, I can just tell you, is substantially higher if we want to achieve the same level of quality that we currently experience in the private sector. If all 60-odd million people are intended to achieve that same level of quality, it's going to be substantially higher than the current over 500 billion rand.
How concerned is the association about this ministerial advisory committee or committees that are going to decide healthcare benefits? I mean, simplistically, it's politicians making medical decisions, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, we are, of course, concerned because I think we've not really understood what those terms of the Ministerial Advisory Committee is going to be doing. And as yet, we haven't received an invite. You know, we'd like to be part of those conversations. We'd like to be involved in it, you know, and provide guidance, provide input. If I can put it this way, nobody knows the private healthcare sector better than the private healthcare sector. So we would like to build, you know, a better healthcare system for all. But, you know, we'd love to be part of the invite to that MEC and other discussions, you know, in unfolding the UHC and NHI.
Are you confident you'll be invited to a seat around that table?
We can only hope. We keep on knocking on the doors and you know, saying we were available and we're happy to have these discussions and, you know, make available our knowledge and skills. So we do hope that, you know, that will actually be received and warmly accepted.
But the fact is that there's been silence so far, and that in itself tells a story, and that's worrying.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously we are concerned, you know, the fact that even before NHI was actually promulgated as a law, we've continuously engaged with government and engaged, you know, the states on the concerns, not just about the funding, but the procurement and all sorts of issues. Unfortunately, none of our suggestions or submissions have actually made it into the final NHI. So we are, you know, we are naturally concerned. But having said that, we always have our door open. We want to collaborate. You know, we want to discuss. So, you know, it is a question of will actually, you know, we be have seats at the table to help engage on that.
Just one final question that the president alluded to last night, the single electronic health record, all part of phase one. Again, in principle, it sounds like a good thing, but you've got to ask the question, does government have the tech capacity to pull it off, or could this be another failed IT project?
So, as I said, I think we haven't actually understood or seen any of the specifications. In principle, you know, having an electronic health record is almost a must-have. It will enable better quality of care, lower costs, you know, and ensure the right appropriate treatments. Unfortunately, we haven't seen any of the details around who is the provider, what will be the technical specs around it, how will it be rolled out, you know, those type of things. So unfortunately, it's difficult to comment on something that we haven't been privy to.
Still a very murky landscape ahead. Thanachin Naidoo, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer of the Health Funders Association.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
A decision by the US government to suspend foreign aid, including critical climate finance, is raising significant concern, and understandably, I guess, about the future of climate change initiatives across the continent. Given that Africa is disproportionately affected by climate change, these funding cuts could pose substantial setbacks. And I want to explore that in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Dr. Okito Wedi, co-founder and chief executive officer of Creative Development, to discuss the potential impacts of these funding reductions and the importance of African-led climate solutions. Dr. Wedi, a very warm welcome to you. So considering Africa's vulnerability to climate change, do you have a view on what the immediate and long-term consequences of these funding cuts are going to be?
Absolutely. I think the funding cuts in the immediate and both long term are going to be massive. In the immediacy, what we'll be seeing is vulnerable communities that rely on these funds for their basic needs like food, clean water, disaster relief. That's going to be dried up, exacerbating an already extenuous situation for many of these communities. In the long term, what this will mean is essentially fewer resources to prepare for these extreme weather events, such as floods and droughts, which we have seen more increasingly in the recent years, making vulnerable communities even more vulnerable. I think something that I think is particularly of concern for me as we look into the future is the bad signal that this sends to other high-emitting wealthy countries around, you know, essentially stepping back from their commitments, right, leaving poorer nations to struggle on their own. And what does accountability look like within this multilateral mechanism that we've agreed on as a global community? So massive impacts on both fronts.
Do you think there might have been a little inertia here as far as risk planning is concerned, and perhaps many of these programs and countries for that matter not working out what would happen if funding were to be cut?
I absolutely do. I am still a little bit surprised myself, to be completely honest, at the shock these programs, communities, and countries are seemingly faced with, as if we didn't know the kind of administration that would be taking place and what that might have meant for how their programs would run, disruptions in funds. These are not secrets, right? So I definitely do, but I think on the other hand, what it does do is it gives us a clear wake-up call, right, around what self-reliance needs to start looking like, that we cannot solely depend on external finance and external help. We need to start looking for alternative sources in the ways we think about how we're going to resource our work and the sustainability and longevity of the work that we do on the African continent. But I absolutely do believe that on many's part, there was an inertia and a kind of wait-and-see posture that many organizations took, which I just think is surprising.
In terms of that self-reliance that you talk about, it is also going to be difficult for African countries at this point to start diversifying their sources of climate finance and looking for alternative funding mechanisms.
Absolutely, it will be. But again, there are a number of current initiatives that are already in play that I think right now the opportunity, particularly with, you know, South Africa taking over as president of the G20, the role of the African Union, mechanisms such as the African Common Free Trade Agreement, I think the priority right now is to invest and scale on initiatives that we already have in place to encourage more public-private partnerships, to encourage big business, African businesses, startups to get in the game, right? Again, I think this narrative that Africa is this sort of sitting duck is a false one, but I do think a much more effort needs to be made around the initiative that we already have in place, that we really need buy-in, that we'll really need investment, and we need to go out there and make it happen. Obviously, I think the shock is with many of these policy shifts having happened in the kind of immediacy with the impact that it's had in such a short term. It has left the global community, particularly Africa, reeling. But again, what choice do we have? Right.
I'm interested to know what your views are then on scalability and partnerships, given that it's probably easier said than done. How does the continent make a compelling case, given that there are so many diverse and competing agendas?
Absolutely. I think that's a great question. One, so at least with creative development, we're in the narrative shifting game. I think, one, there is a role of just, you know, shifting a narrative around, you know, opportunities within Africa as a global leader, as we think about, you know, its renewable energy potential, its youth populations, it's the potential around innovation, around climate adaptation. I think there is a piece of work that needs to be done around the story that we're telling about Africa. Which I know you do a lot of work around. And then, yes, thinking beyond just the U.S. in terms of partnership, right? Are we looking to strengthen, are we looking to secure fair trade deals and strengthen relationships with the EU, with the China, with India, with Gulf states, right? Are we looking at non-state actors? Are we thinking about private sector in the way that it should be in terms of opportunities to scale and invest on these initiatives? And are we thinking about how we are going to actively strengthen regional cooperation, right, to be able to ensure trade and the transfer of goods and technologies across borders? I think there's a significant piece that needs to be done around that regional strengthening piece, and this essentially needing to come to the fore in this particular time.
A lot of food for thought, and by all accounts, an enormous amount of work to be done. Dr. Okito Weddy, thank you very much indeed, co-founder, chief executive officer of Creative Development. And that's also our program for today and the week. We're back on Monday with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.